I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Speaking yesterday in Tulsa, Oklahoma, President Biden declared that, quote, terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland today. Not ISIS, not Al-Qaeda, white supremacy. Earlier this year, FBI Director Christopher Wray told the U.S. Senate that domestic terrorism is metastasizing across the country. Today on Radio Times, we take you inside one of these domestic terrorism hate groups called The Base. Its goal is to bring about the collapse of the United States by starting a race war. Our guests, Jamila Paxima and Geraldine Mariba, are the co-hosts of the podcast Sounds Like Hate, produced with the Southern Poverty Law Center. They listen to 83 hours of secret recruitment audio recordings by The Base, interviewed a wide range of people, and profiled one family, Tristan Webb, who joined The Base while in high school, his father, Eric Webb, and his grandmother, Carol Teagarden, both of whom tried to pull Tristan away from the group. WHYY is broadcasting the radio version of Sounds Like Hate, Sundays at 4 through the month of June. Let me welcome our two guests. Jamila Paxima is an award-winning journalist and a filmmaker, joining us by Skype. And Jamila, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here, Marty.
Also with us, as I said, Geraldine Mariba. She's a Peabody and Emmy Award-winning journalist, senior vice president of the Griot News and Entertainment. And Geraldine Mariba, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. It's great to be here.
Well, I think we know about the Proud Boys. We know about Oath Keepers and some other of these extremist white supremacist groups. What do we need to know about The Base? And Geraldine, let me start with you. What sets them apart, if anything?
Well, what's we found as we were doing this story is, first of all, there are a lot of groups in the country. But the story that we found isn't so much about what you expect of these groups. They're not necessarily older. They're not necessarily overtly violent. They're everyday people who are integrated into our lives. There are working in our post offices, in our grocery stores, in very high finance situations. They're wealthy and they're poor. They're young and they're old. They are malcontent or in very stable situations. Some were homeless on these calls, and some had really strong family support. So it's hard to predict who joins these types of groups.
Jamila, let me turn to you. This group is described as a neo-Nazi accelerationist. It's a survivalist group as well. Again, sort of help us understand some of the features here.
What this group is looking for is what they call the collapse of America or the collapse of society. They're hoping that various races will turn against each other. They're looking for opportunities when chaotic things happen. For example, when the George Floyd demonstrations started happening this summer, this was the kind of moments they were trying to take advantage of and opportunities showing that our current society cannot handle itself, and that this would create power vacuums and opportunities for their group to grow. They also are very much all about separating races. They're all about being white, and you have to pass the bar of whiteness, you know, in order to join their group. And so the goal is to have these like cells all around the United States where they're ready for the collapse, and these small cells will harbor like-minded folks and like colored folks.
Let me turn back to you, Geraldine. You listened to 83 hours of some of these secret recordings, and there are a number of them included in the podcast and will be on the radio as well, and we're going to play some of them as well. Is this just talk? Is it action? How do we separate those two?
It's definitely predominantly talk. Most of it is talk. Most of it is just some mostly men getting together and expressing themselves in situations where they feel safe because they think they're speaking among like-minded people. But while these recordings were mostly men, all of these men have women behind them. So women are involved too. But yeah, I would say that what we learned is that this is a way for people to feel like they're a part of something larger than their current reality.
Let me turn back to you, Jamila. I do want to play Rinaldo Nazzaro. He is, I guess, the founder of the base. Interestingly, went to Villanova University, which is outside of Philadelphia. What do we need to know about him, Jamila, before we play this clip?
Well, Rinaldo Nazzaro has worked for the U.S. government, he claims, and worked in intelligence. He is married to a Russian woman. He has a security company, and now he lives in St. Petersburg, Russia, but he has been operating the base from that location. He also, pretty much right after Charlottesville, started posting a lot of videos and podcasts online around accelerationism and preparing and training for a race war. And this is sort of how he built up his name.
Well, this is him speaking with a potential recruit to the base, known as the Ecologist. And here he is talking about the purpose of the group and the criteria for joining. Let's give it a listen.
We want to be in a position where we're ready, we're prepared enough, ready enough that we can take advantage of whatever chaos or power vacuum that might emerge. Most of us are national socialists, but there are others who just consider themselves white nationalists. Being pro-white is the number one criteria.
And to you, Geraldine, I'm always hesitant about, playing. Your series includes a lot of these interviews, and I'm always hesitant or have to think twice about putting them on the radio because we don't want to be in the process of recruiting people while we're talking about something like the base. How should we listen to and how should we understand what's going on in these recruitments?
So, we have the same concern. We were very, very selective in what we were comfortable sharing and what we chose not to share. But I think that as you listen, it's important to understand that these aren't coded messages.
Right.
They're very clear and direct and open about their goals. This is an expression of malcontent. And there's a real intentionality about it. And the intention is the destruction of America. And so when we receive these secret recordings from what they call a vetting room, their recruiting room, where they're determining who gets in and who doesn't, and just so you know, the methodology of determining who gets in is filled with holes and sometimes illogical. Their conversations are really illogical, but we knew we could do more than just piece together their narratives. We could gain valuable insights into the words they use, the tone, their habits, and the reasons behind why they behave the way they do. So for us, this was less about just saying, here's a story about a bunch of guys. It's more an exploration of their motivations.
And to you, Jamila, I do want to play one more clip talking about sort of the use of certain language, but do we know how many people are in the base?
Well, apparently the base is defunct right now, but at, I would say, its height, it could have potentially been between maybe 80 really active members. There were a lot more people who tried to get recruited in. We listened to over 120 different individual vetting calls.
Well, let me play one more clip. And again, this is Rinaldo Nazzaro. He's speaking with base recruit, again, the Ecologist, about what drew him to white supremacist hate groups. And there's this reference to red pilling. Let's give it a listen.
What was a red pilling moment for you in your life?
It was overall just growing up in California. I was surrounded by mostly like Filipinos, Asians, Mexicans, Blacks, and just watching how they behave and watching, like, I don't know, occasionally like white women intermingle with them. It just disgusted me.
Jamila, what's red pilling?
Well, this is the awakening moment. It's either when they realize that there's another race that's trying to overpower them. If feminists are trying to take over, there's race mixing. It's the moment where they woke up and realized they need to preserve the white race and they need to do something about it. And so this is one of the number one questions that's been part of the vetting call with Nazzaro. He always asks this question. Sometimes it happens for folks reading various kinds of literature, and we were very careful not to talk about their manifestos and who these leaders are and so forth, and we're not going to propagate that either here. But it's the big turning point moment for them.
And can I also
go ahead,
Marty?
Geraldine. Sure, go ahead.
That the phrase red pill comes from the movie The Matrix. And one of the things that we noticed in these conversations is there's many, many references to pop culture. And they use it to be light and funny and snarky, but they also use it as a way of making people feel comfortable. So when you look at their social media posts, they're often using handles that grab names from their most popular films, the ones they like and crowd around. And it's a way of making the recruits feel comfortable, like, oh, there's a familiarity here, a culture familiarity.
And Jamila, you interviewed a number of people who are, you know, have studied some of these hate groups, and one of them talked about this, the kind of paranoia inside these groups. And I wondered, Jamila, if you could speak to that.
Oh, absolutely. So these groups know that they're being listened to and watched. They're aware that not only is law enforcement, FBI trying to infiltrate these groups, there are journalists who are trying to infiltrate these groups.
And there's
anti-fascist organizations that are trying to infiltrate these groups. So while at the same time, it seems like they're speaking unfiltered, they're always saying, hey, you've got to be careful about your OPSEC and your security and what you really say, because you never know who's listening. And it's so fascinating because we were able to get our hands on these recordings, and they're in virtually every phone call. Somebody says, hey, be careful. Somebody might be listening.
As you were listening.
They go on. Exactly. As we're listening. And so in some aspects, it's like, did you really say that? You know, it's like a little bit of like, are you guys knuckleheads? Because like you're saying things that you probably shouldn't be saying. Ronaldo Nazzaro would often try to rein people in if they start talking about violence and other things that they'd like to do, action-oriented activities. When they start talking about using guns and weapons, like he would always try to rein in the conversation. He's like, whoa, 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 whoa. We gotta be careful what we're saying on here right now.
Well, let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation with our guest. That's Jamila Paxima, also with us, Geraldine Moriba, and they are co-hosts of a podcast called Sounds Like Hate. It's produced with and made with the Southern Poverty Law Center. A radio version is airing this month, Sunday afternoon at 4 here at WHYY. Stay with us. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about why and how some people get pulled into extremist hate groups, what family and friends can do to try to pull them back out. Our guests are Geraldine Moriba and Jamila Paxima. They are hosts of a podcast series from the Southern Poverty Law Center called Sounds Like Hate. And among a number of interviews that they did profile a family where the young teenage son was pulled into this organization called The Base. They listened to something like 83 hours of secret recruitment audio recordings. Let me play one more recording. And again, this is Ronaldo Nazzaro speaking to a young recruit based near Easton, Pennsylvania. Now, this clip did not appear in the Baseless series, was part of SPLC's reporting, and is used by Radio Times with their permission. Let's give it a listen.
We encourage our members, like when they do meet up, to, you know, take pictures, for example, that we can kind of turn into propaganda, things like that. And if you follow my timeline at all on Gab, the base account. I mean, you kind of get an idea of some of the content we put out. And
this is the first time that I'm actually like transitioning from it being ideology to it being real life, you know?
Right, right. And that's a great way to describe it. That's it in a nutshell. I mean, but ultimately, what really binds us is our desire to be active in real life.
All right. Sounds great, guys. It's great talking to you.
And you can talk to us. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Geraldine, this was a conversation of someone who was in Easton. As the both of you described, this was an organization that had cells around the country. How much was Pennsylvania sort of a part of this organization, Geraldine?
Well, I will say that what's fascinating is while there are ultimately a small number of people who join the organization, this group, their reach was quite extensive. And there was a significant number of people who, and we don't know how much of them are telling the truth or lying, by the way, but there is a significant number of people who were in Pennsylvania. And what's really fascinating about that clip you just played is it's really important to point out how quickly terroristic ideology spread today, especially among young people, because they're easily targeted where they gather on social media or gaming platforms and YouTube. And then also, you know, we found that among these platforms, the recruits came specifically from a couple of places where you find young people. So the base was targeting them consciously, and it was iFunny and 4chan. People in their mid-20s and younger came from those two places, and Twitter as well, whereas the older recruits came from Facebook. Uh-huh. So they were looking for people in specific demographics in the places where they communicate and hang out, and they found them.
Well, they did, including a young man, a high schooler named Eric Webb. Jamila Paxima, help us understand who Eric is.
Eric was a 17-year-old, and we first heard about him on our first set of in the vetting calls. He stood out to us because at the age of 17, he had already started his own group, which was Aryan Resistance in high school. He, in his vetting call, talked about being called Jesus Hitler at school because he was professing his National Socialist ideals. He also talked about being visited by the FBI and ATF because he already had guns and he was building a silencer. And his school was concerned he might be a shooter, a school shooter. So there were a lot of red flags about this young man. But what made him most interesting to Ronaldo Nazaro on the base was that he and his family had property, and he was offering his property as training ground for what the base calls hate camps, where they would get together and do their paramilitary training. And this is really what differentiates the base from many other groups, because they actively were training and recruiting folks. And part of the recruiting was they were often looking for folks with military experience so that they could train all these young men who wanted to learn how to use their guns.
Jamila, you interviewed him, Tristan Webb, and one of the things you asked him is, you know, is there anything that could have prevented you from either joining this group or having some of this hateful ideology and ideas? And his answer seemed to be no.
Exactly. It was in his recruiting call, he even talked about the fact that his grandmother very early on must have been the one who called the ATF and the FBI. There were folks in school who were concerned. And once I talked to him, spoke to his grandmother, who was very concerned as he was growing up and could see him going down this path of radicalization, she tried to intercede several times. She tried to get close to him, travel with him. You know, this young man, Tristan, comes from a upper middle class family. His father's an optometrist. His family did go through a divorce.
That any. Sorry, it's okay. Live radio. That's okay.
Okay.
Go ahead, Jamila.
That many of his issues started to evolve from the separation of his parents, and he had a lot of, you know, depression, psychological issues that his grandmother talked about, but he didn't think any of that had contributed to him looking for alternative places to belong.
In fact, she describes, you know, seeing him watching Nazi videos and, you know, seeing him being pulled into or gravitating to this hateful, obviously frightening ideology.
He found a girlfriend in Australia who was a national socialist, and the grandmother actually thought it was this lovely young girl that he met as a teenager, and this would be a good distraction. So she went to Australia with him, and he found someone across the pond, so to speak. I mean, he was constantly looking for someone who he could identify with and belong with, and he was always actively recruiting. And eventually we were able to find some of the police reports and school records from high school, where there was a lot of concerns about him. Police were called to the school a couple of times. His car was searched. He was distributing propaganda at school. And what it really does red flag is there have been a lot of early signs with a young man like Tristan. And as we started looking at other men, young men, a lot of this does start very early on, and the community actually can get involved very early on. And the parents did try, but it didn't seem to work. At the same time, I would say, and Geraldine would probably agree with me, the father in some ways enabled a lot of the opportunities for this young man to pursue what he wanted to pursue instead of stopping it.
Well, let me see if we got Geraldine back without her dog to respond to that. And I do want to play a clip actually from Tristan's dad. His name is Eric Webb, talking about what might have influenced his son to be attracted to some of this white supremacy thinking. Let me play that, and then Geraldine, I'll give you a chance to respond. This is RTOT Webb.
Okay. A lot of people want to blame. They want to look for a source. In my view of the world, a lot of people go, well, where do you learn this kind of stuff from? Well, he didn't learn it from me. Wouldn't have learned it from my mom or my dad.
Do you think he had extremist views when you were young?
No, never.
Are you a National Socialist?
No.
Have you ever denied the Holocaust?
No.
Do you idolize Hitler?
No.
To you, Geraldine, and you say in this series that the dad, he did some things, but he sort of looked the other way when it came to other things. Help us understand that.
Yeah, I mean, what's fascinating about the father in this story is the absence of accountability and how he takes no responsibility for the things that happened in his property. But the reality is his son lived on property that he owned with his ex-wife and little brother, but also at times five or six different men who were openly using guns and strategizing and expressing hate. And Eric Webb saw all of this. And yeah, he did intervene in small ways, but he never stopped it, and he didn't prevent it from happening. And so in some ways, he facilitated it by letting these men come and occupy property they had no right to be on.
And in fact, Jamila, his dad didn't even know he had Nazi tattoos.
I think the situation with the father is that he would come and go every few months. And so he'd come, take a look around. I mean, he talked about he walked in the barn and he saw these giant swastika banners and posters of Hitler, and they would call it the Hitler room. And he wouldn't. And I'm like, well, why don't you tear it all down and take it down and say they can't have it? And he's like, well, you know, they're living here. They're now, he's turned 18. There's young men, they're adults. And he also would go out and buy them ammo because he thought it would, you know, they're young men. They just like to shoot guns out in the woods. I mean, there were things he did that completely enabled some of this behavior. He helped pay for animals and hogs and all these other things that he thought that they were raising animals and tending the land. But none of that was actually happening. And he didn't stand up for it. And it wasn't until he realized they went to a George Floyd demonstration in their town of Bad Axe in Michigan with their AR-15s that he became concerned, because they were holding his guns that were the ones that he had purchased.
And that was for him, what, the final straw?
Right, because he was like, oh, I didn't know that he could go open carry this downtown in front of crowds of people. And here he is, a 17, 18-year-old kid. The smallest thing could trigger something very violent and change the future for many people. And that moment was a wake-up call for him. So he, you know, charged back up to his country house trying to get his guns back. And at that point, it was almost like a standoff. They didn't want him in the house. He didn't want to get in the house. These men are now in his family property and wouldn't give back all the guns. There was like one large gun that he didn't get back, and he was really frustrated. So he contacted the local police to help him.
And Marty.
Yeah, go ahead. Geraldine.
I would say that's one of the things we've been trying in all of the stories is that we're reporting on, is not to just reveal what's happening in America today, but also to try and provide solutions. And in this case, what we hope people who are listening understand is parents need to respond effectively and early. Like, early intervention and prevention stops these things from happening exponentially. And it does mean listening to the music and the lyrics of the songs your children listen to. It does mean supporting them when there are extreme situations that may cause trauma or stress in their lives or the loved ones in your family. Because what research is showing is while people aren't necessarily born being racist, they learn it. And they also move into these groups and become these sort of extremists when there's sort of a conflation of circumstances. And it's also why we do need an investment in terms of our national infrastructure. So we are providing support to our community in ways that help families and teachers, educators, first responders to deal with people who are already, as they say, red-pilled.
Red-pilled. Let me play one more clip from the series. And again, this is, Jamila made reference to this. It's a 911 call that Eric Webb made trying to remove weapons from his son's possession at the base in this small town.
Huron County 911, do you have an emergency?
I'm trying to collect a weapon from my son. I'm more fearful of the guys that are out here with him. He does have some white nationalists that are out here with him.
And who is your son?
His name is Tristan. I let him live in my house with my ex-wife. Now he's got a bunch of white nationalists live with him.
And to you, Jamila, as you said, this was the last straw in certain ways for the father. What happened at this farm, this sort of outpost farm?
What was happening there was they were doing paramilitary training every day. There was a young man who became the self-proclaimed leader of the base. His name was AK or Justin Watkins. He later was arrested by the FBI. But from what I understand from speaking with Tristan, was he really wanted them to work out every day and perfect their paramilitary skills. They were also prepping, so they had a lot of food stored and beans and all kinds of other things. And they were and we're still trying to determine what other sort of equipment and gear they had. Ultimately, AK was arrested by the FBI, and his real name is Justin Watkins. And in that incident with the father, he tried to attack him that day, and he was told to by the police to just back off and just go away, because it might turn into something ugly. And that's ultimately what happened, until 4 months later, the FBI showed up and raided the property.
And you and Geraldine were able to go to the property to look at what it looked like after that raid. Jamila, what did you see?
Well, you know, this is the aftermath of a hate camp, I suppose. I asked the father if he would let me go back with him for the first time after that incident. And so we traveled together, and he was just discovering step by step, you know, the trash and the of what was left behind. This was his childhood home, and everything had been turned inside out, partially by the way they were living, and partially, I think, by the FBI looking for clues. There was a lot of propaganda that was taped to every window of the house, which was interesting. There these stickers that said "Hate is not a crime," a lot of stickers about white power. There was they had been stockpiling apparently gas masks and other kinds of things that the FBI removed. We don't know how many guns they ultimately removed, but there's swastikas on doors, on bathrooms, spray painted inside the house, beer bottles, and just trash everywhere. And it was a bit devastating for the father to take a really deep look at what he allowed to have happen in his family home where he grew up.
Well, we're going to take a very short break and get back to our conversation. That's Jamila Paksima, Geraldine Moriba. They are co-hosts of Sounds Like Hate. It's a podcast, and it's going to be a radio show here at WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane, talking with Geraldine Moriba and Jamila Paksima about their podcast series with the Southern Poverty Law Center. It's called Sounds Like Hate. They join us to talk about something called The Base. It was a white supremacist terrorist group planning for a race war. They focus on one family, a teenage boy who joined The Base, his father and his grandmother. WHYY is carrying the radio version of this series this month, Sunday afternoons at 4 o'clock. We've got a lot of people that want to join our conversation. And let me just make sure you can do that. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always pick up the phone and give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Let me read a comment from Chris, who put this up pretty early in the show. What can we do in the immediate that can have a great effectiveness to combat this hate? If there's a flood in your house, you immediately shut off the water. Social media spreading this like fire, as well as the tone of Fox News. He says, I know we can't shut down social media. What can we do? And Geraldine, let me toss that to you. As you both have mentioned, especially for some of these young recruits, social media is a very effective and powerful recruitment tool.
Yeah, I mean, I think that not only to combat white supremacy and Nazism and extremism that's happening in America and frankly globally right now, and it's never gone away, it's been here, but the way that we have to combat it spreading so rapidly now is with media literacy. There is so much garbage and so much falsehood that spreads, and we have to consciously question what people share with us, whether you get it in WhatsApp or you find it on Facebook or in a gaming device. We have to ask questions like, what's the root of the information we're receiving? Go to the source if you can, but independently verify the legitimacy, because what happens more and more, because of the way we spread information now, is confirmation bias. We might already have a bias to believe something, and then we look for things that confirm it, whether or not they're true, and just hold on to them. So it's really critical in these spaces where there are no filters that we're being analytical and raising questions.
Jamila, just picking up on that, but giving it a kind of a psychological spin, when you look at Tristan's family, you see addiction, you see dysfunction, I guess, for lack of a better word. You see problems in the family. Now, not everyone who has that is going to join a hate group, but it seems that there are risks associated with that for people that want to find someone who can give them a reason for their rage and anger and depression.
Exactly. I think that, you know, families need to do what they can to speak to the children and the adults who are influencing them, and if necessary, extract them from those big influences. I think a lot of what some of these young people seem to be looking for was someone who would listen to them and talk to them and try to understand where they're coming from. And as they search, as they get older and they can't find more like-minded folks, it becomes harder. We did another story in a high school where we were interviewing some young people who were also on the radicalization pathway. And this seems to be the pattern. Like, they are often kids who are on the fringe and on the outs. And so it does require the community and teachers and so forth not to like look at them as children who might be concerning and problems. It's like, this is an opportunity for me to bring this person into the fold, try to understand where they are, let them try to understand other people's experiences of other races. And I think this is all a bit of an experiment right now, but we cannot separate them. I think that is the biggest distinction.
Separate them, meaning we need to figure out how to integrate them into the larger world?
Yes. And they want to belong. They want to be a part of society and community as well. And I think that often they feel like because they're not understood, they start trying to attract attention with all of these different reaction symbols and shocking their community and their parents. These are all like signs that they're seeking attention at the same time. There's something else at the root of why they're so unhappy.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from Stu, who says, haters have always been here. Now right-wing politicians openly pander to them, and technology makes it easier for them to recruit and organize. A commenter who actually didn't want to share their name, all the attention paid to their psychological issues is a waste of time and redirects attention away from how to stop them from doing harm. Geraldine, let me pick up on that and toss that to you. And I mean, in this country, you can think hateful, horrible things. You cannot, we're not allowed to attack people and do violence against people, but we can think violent, horrible things. How do we separate those two?
Well, I mean, here's one thing that we observed in these secret recordings. These men were watching President Trump when he was still in office. His name was brought up on these recordings 69 times, which means it was mentioned in 18% of the conversations. So one of the questions we're trying to answer with this podcast is whether white supremacy groups are being taken seriously enough, given the volatility of that administration, which hasn't gone away. Racism has been here for a long time, but because of all of the...
Whoops, I think we lost Geraldine there. We'll try to reconnect her. Did we lose Geraldine? Yes, we did. Okay. Jamila, do you want to pick up on that? Sorry to drop that in your lap there.
Sure. I think we're looking at is that racism and hate are a part of our everyday life, but I also think that there needs to be, from what we have heard from folks who've tried to get out of these groups, is they need to know that there's a safe way to do that. Mm-hmm. And there's a place where they can do that when they're ready. And so those openings have to be available, those opportunities in communities as well, or organizations. For example, there's one like Life After Hate and so forth. There has to be somewhere where they can go to it, almost like a 12-step program, confess like what has all happened to them when they're ready to do that. So even Tristan himself said that he couldn't take the intensity of living in that compound that became his, you know, that was his house, the base. And he left a few weeks before the FBI raid. He still has a lot of national socialist ideas in his head. He did get tattoos on his face that his father didn't know about. But at the same time, there are a lot of people who are still trying to get to speak to him. And his father wants that open door to always be there. And so, you know, it's a balancing act. How do you allow folks to work their way out if you don't continue to communicate with them?
You know, Jamila, as you were talking about, both you and Geraldine talking about the father and, you know, his denial and his sort of half-hearted efforts to try to reach his son. I mean, I wonder whether that's sort of represents us as a country, which is we haven't really grappled with where these hate groups come from and the kind of threat that they pose to our democracy.
The thing is, we don't know what our kids are hearing and listening to in their earbuds for hours and hours a day. We don't know the passwords that they have. And as parents, it's our responsibility to figure out how to have an open communication with our children and see what they're hearing and listen to what they're hearing. And I do agree. I mean, I think a lot of us have become a bit complacent, thinking, maybe one day they'll grow out of it. I mean, this is what a lot of parents say. They'll grow out of it. It's a phase. But sometimes it will suck your child in to very, very dangerous places. And it might be too late if you don't constantly work at it and work at including your children in every phase of life.
Jamila, you interviewed Tristan. You know that's included in the series. So, what was it like to talk to him? And were there things that you held back on just because he's not your son? You know.
So, there was a lot that was shocking in speaking to him, and I think he was trying to shock me as well.
Yeah.
The point where he started talking about the fact that the Holocaust never existed. But he wished that it did. It was really disturbing to me. And here I am trying to reason with someone who is so unreasonable. I'm like, how can you say that 6 million people did not get tortured and murdered in the most heinous, you know, crime that has ever happened to a community of people? And only later to learn from his father that they actually have Jewish relatives, but the father never pressed him on any of this. And at the same time, as a reporter, you're like, okay, can I like really go in there and tell him he's, you know, out of his mind? Is he going to slam the phone down, or do I keep trying to talk to him and see, is there going to be more communication? And so you can understand, this is where, as a journalist, it gets hard. Like, how far do you push?
Yeah.
But, what was interesting to me was, and you will see, is he found another woman who is a young woman who's very much like-minded like him, even though he moved out of Michigan and has gone somewhere else. He's still searching for people who think like him. And so he doesn't quite believe everything his father says. And he just wants to figure out how to have a quiet life separate, living as a white person right now.
Yeah. Geraldine, let me read a comment from Karen. She says, please speak about the possible connection of Russia to this group, considering Putin's desire to exploit divisions in the U.S. using witting and unwitting assets to harm our country. It does not seem coincidental that the base's leader has a Russian wife and currently lives in St. Petersburg in Russia. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, well, we don't know for a fact that the Russian government is involved with the creation of the base or supports Nazarro in any way. We know we believe it's being investigated, but we were not able to definitively answer any of those questions. What we do know is he lives there. He is married to a Russian woman, and it doesn't seem likely that he's going to be returning to the U.S. We also know that 20% of the applicants to this group claim to have American combat training, including Nazarro, and they served or did serve or were currently in active duty. And that is also worth noting. Like, there were, of the people we listened to, 8 men were in the National Guard. One was a former member of the Air Force. There was a Marine, and 8 in the U.S. Army. So anyone with a military background was more desirable to the base and often given very easy access to their organization and the ability to immediately start to network. So while we look at that Russia, we also have to look at ourselves.
Let me quote one more thing, and Jamila, I'll go back to you. And this is Ronaldo Nazarro. He's the founder of the base. He's talking to a guy named Chris Hood, and he says, we're not going to be like storming Washington, D.C., right? I mean, like, that's we just don't have the numbers, do we? I mean, not now, at least, you know, if ever. But we want things to accelerate. You know, we want things to get worse in the United States. Now, this was before the insurrection on January 6th at the U.S. Capitol. But I thought that was very telling comment on his part.
It really stood out. And after, in fact, there was another recruit who talked about storming the Capitol and going in there and with ammunition and guns and actually, you know, attacking and killing all the congressmen and senators. I mean, this idea of storming the Capitol has been clearly around in white nationalist communities for some time. Those recordings that we have are from 2019. Right. And so this was not a new idea. It was just, you know, it found fire and fuel with Donald Trump.
And we're almost out of time. Jamila, just a quick response, if you don't mind. So the base no longer exists, or it's not what it was 2 years ago?
So one of the unfortunate things that does happen with these groups is they don't last very long, because as they get infiltrated, the base has had a number of arrests with the FBI. There's over 9 different individuals, 3 different cells that have now been exposed, and there are these active prosecutions going forward. So it seems to have collapsed. However, this young man, for example, Chris Hood, from what we understand, has formed a new group that is sort of like an offshoot from the base. And he is a serial a group changer. Like, he started with Patriot Front and moved into another group and another group. And so now he has a group called NSC, the National Socialist Club 131, in the Boston area. And so law enforcement and all of us who are concerned about the influence these groups have to stay vigilant and keep trying to track them as they're deplatformed from one place to another.
We have to leave it there. Jamila Paxima, Geraldine Mariba, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. Co-hosts of the podcast Sounds Like Hate, a podcast by the Southern Poverty Law Center. A radio version will air here at WHYY Sunday afternoons during the month of June at 4 o'clock. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder and Kelsey Henson and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.